Welcome to Keldabe Talk Radio, the official podcast of the Mandalorian Mercs. We're a costume organization dedicated to charity efforts around the globe, attending events in Mandalorian armor we've built by hand. Here on the show, we'll keep you up to date with the latest fan community news. Visit our website at www.mandalorianmercs.com.
Hello and welcome to this month's edition of Keldabe Talk Radio. I am your host, Crow, and with me is my co-host, Thaxos.
Hey, hey.
We also have Frost.
Yo.
And with us we have special guest, John Ficker. You may see him on the boards as Lone Wolf 1183, or you may know him as the Executioner Mando.
Hey, everybody.
Alright, so, John, what do you do in the Mercs? Like, what is... what's your thing?
I'm not involved in the Mercs in terms of, like, there's no, like, leadership position or anything like that that I hold. I'm just always, like, with Mandalorian Mercs, I mean, I did a suit way years ago. And I've always just enjoyed it because it kind of gave you that freedom to kind of, I think for the reason a lot of people like to do it, where you get to just come up with your own take on the suit and be a little creative or flexible or kind of take that styling, that iconic look of Boba Fett, and push it towards some other category or some other style that that we haven't seen on screen in books in the universe thus far. So I'm always sitting there. I mean, I'm actually a product designer in real life. So sitting there and sketching and doodling and thinking up things is kind of right up my alley. So I've got, pads and pads of sketches and loose papers and notebooks, and heck, even to this day, you know, sitting there in boring meetings at work kind of thing, you know, doodling in the margins of my notepads kind of stuff. We're all, you know, I'll just think up and doodle little ideas or differences in the suits of armor. So I'm kind of just, you know, I like doing that sort of creative thing where you think of the possibilities that you can take the suits and what a Mandalorian might be, or what some kind of, like, you know, a pilot version of Boba Fett, or a soldier version of Boba Fett, or a more like a grunt, you know, versus a specialized kind of suit, you know. So that's what I kind of look at and do suits.
Cool.
So I mean, usually, like with myself, I'm very much more like an original trilogy type leaning in my design styles and my views on the suit, just because to me the original trilogy is much more what Star Wars was or is. You know, it was the birth of it. It's kind of like what was the most iconic. Typically, I kind of lose it a little bit in the prequels, just because what was neat is that the original trilogy really set that aesthetic of what Star Wars is. And when you look at it, it's kind of a what you could almost call like a World War II cyberpunk kind of thing. It's like everything in the original trilogy typically is kind of, you know, it's wooden grips, World War II surplus. I mean, you've got things like what DL-19 that the Stormtroopers carry, the long rifle, is a MG-34 machine gun. You know, things like the Stormtrooper blaster is a Sterling machine gun that's got some greeblies and stuff glued onto it. So everything is very much kind of that World War II kind of surplus look to it.
Yeah.
Prequel trilogies, you kind of start to get this just because of how 20, 30 years have changed. Instead of just going, oh, what can we grab surplus and slap stuff on, it's now, oh, hey, we can sketch it and dream it and then wrap prototype it, and you get these beautiful, like, back metalized and, you know, fiberglass cast and really, you know, specialized fabric costume, things like that, versus just, hey, we need some, like, utilitarian jumpsuits, and we're going to use that jumpsuit pattern on everything kind of thing. So, basically, like, the reason I look, you know, the original trilogy is sort of that original establishing look of the Star Wars universe, and the reason I tend to lean towards that is because of that reason. It is what we were introduced to, and the reason I tend to kind of shy away from the prequel trilogy a little bit is just because in the time frame of 20 years or so since the original trilogy was made and the prequel trilogy started being made, the advances in filmmaking technology itself and just general technology meant that you have these, instead of just one or two artists like Ralph McQuarrie and those types just having a little input sketch and then the costume and wardrobe department kind of scavenging whatever they could, now you have the ability to bring in all kinds of artists, and they can do a digital sketch and then make a digital model of that, and then rapid prototype, and then now you've got this ability to have these beautiful, immaculate, crazy shaped stuff. They're able to go out and get very specific, one-off designed fabrics.
Yeah.
Versus the original trilogy was very much just this utilitarian fabric of like, hey, we just need a utility fabric. We'll have this one kind of jumpsuit, and that jumpsuit pattern is used for everyone, i.e. AT-AT pilots, Imperial crewmen, TIE fighter pilots, X-Wing pilots, some of your background characters, some of your background bounty hunters, all wore the exact same jumpsuit.
Wilbro Hood.
Done in different colors. You're the ice cream maker man kind of thing. therefore that reason, I tend to go I skew towards the original trilogy a little bit, just because I think that is the Star Wars universe. And kind of the reason for that adhering to a look is, I kind of mentioned my background is in industrial design, product design. So in product design, you're kind of taught to have to pay attention to and adhere to a family of form or a family of look, where to use an example, like the car industry, like if you go out on as you're just driving along and look, you can very quickly look at a car and that's a Ford or that's a Honda. You don't even have to necessarily see the badge on the front of the grill. You just know that's a Ford, or that's a Honda. And the reason I bring that up is because, every kind of genre or, well done movie franchise kind of has their own visual aesthetic. It's sort of like, Star Wars is that much that kind of World War II cyber diesel punk kind of thing.
Yeah,
they call it the dirty universe, don't they?
They call it the dirty universe because it was the first one to actually have grime on everything. Previous to that, everything was always shown as a very
the future was clean.
Logan's Run,
you actually had grime and dirt and weathering and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but it just to look at it, it's like Firefly / Serenity is cowboy, right? Like everything kind of has that look of the old west little bit.
All the guns are like, it's a LeMat, it's not even modified, it's just a LeMat, that sort of thing.
Star Trek is silver, and the shapes that they have with the Federation stuff and the different clans. So it's sort of like a really good example if you get down into it is like in the Lord of the Rings universe, when you start looking at the way that they planned out every different culture kind of thing. But and even within the Lord of the Rings thing, that kind of falls in that fantasy a realm sort of thing of horses and chainmail and stuff like that. So there's usually a very specific look to what is Star Wars. So I tend to like adhere to that and think very heavily of that. So whenever I'm designing stuff, my brain is always, what is, if I were a costume designer in 1976 or 77 and I had to be tasked to put together a suit that was like, the legion of soldiers behind Boba Fett. And that's why some people may know I did that that Mandalorian pilot helmet, and the whole reason to make it look the way it was based off the fact that in the movies, in the original trilogy, the pilot helmet, the X-Wing pilot helmets, the X-Wing pilots wore was the original Air Force pilot helmet was.
For the record, it's the U.S. Air Force APH-6B helmets.
What plane was that known for though, right?
I don't know, they used it in the Vietnam War. I don't remember what plane.
I think it was kind of a general issue helmet.
Yeah. But then they used that exact same helmet kind of merged into a stormtrooper helmet for the TIE fighters and the AT pilots kind of thing. So I really like that sort of X-Wing pilot helmet look, so I merge that on top of a Boba Fett helmet, and that was how I got to the Mando. Yeah. So the suit that I'm known for, the Executioner, was kind of just that experiment with sitting there doodling and pushing the boundaries of saying how far can I go, with the look of Boba Fett, to where I push that to where it's still recognizable as Boba Fett, but not too far. And some people will probably disagree with me, but I myself even kind of think that maybe the Executioner suit, I kind of toe the line. I just toe over the line. And in reality, I mean, there's a lot of suits I see these days that I kind of go, okay, that pushes it a lot farther than I did. So maybe I didn't push as far as I personally believe, kind of thing. But even the executioner, you know, mindful to go, okay, I'm going to have like, you know, a utility fabric flight suit, leather belt, pouches. Another thing that I'm always cognizant of is that whenever I'm designing a custom suit, there's a thing they always did in the original trilogy, not so much in the prequel trilogy, but in the original trilogy, they always reused a lot of details or greeblies, and greeblies being that term for just general kind of junk that you know, glued on, details, stuff like that. So a lot of greeblies and details were reused. I mean, you look at Darth Vader has the three what are referred to as coin slots on his chest box. Those are the exact same coin slots that are on R2-D2, and there's six of them on R2-D2.
Yeah.
You know, you get little details like that. So I'm always very cognizant to try to purposefully, you know, with very great intention, you know, reuse one or two little details. I mean, like, I've got stuff to the level of, like, there's a people who were at, Con Carolinas last year saw, that's when I debuted the kind of blaster rifle that I built for the executioner. And I've got a Boba Fett knee dart on the tip of one of the pipes on that blaster rifle. You know, things like, while there, I would use like R2-D2 ankle cylinders, and I kind of still can for when I've done belt commissions and stuff, where, you know, these belt, you know, the R2-D2 ankle cylinders, when seen by themselves on a belt, don't register necessarily as R2-D2, but they register as familiar to the Star Wars universe. So there's little greeblies like that that I'll reuse. So a lot of times, it's that, you know, that intentional reuse of something else from in the Star Wars universe that can make a very good, you know, costume detail. And that's not to say that, you know, you should go, okay, you know, Darth Vader has this awesome chest armor, I'm going to put that on my Mando, therefore it's reusing Star Wars universe stuff. No, I mean, you got to kind of pay attention to, you know, not reusing very iconic stuff, but, you know, just the little details that kind of try to reuse and put into things. That's kind of how I tend to sort of go about designing. And then I've also just through plenty of years of you know, paying attention to this stuff, and then also you know, being around people who have done Boba Fett and Jango Fett costumes, and just the years of being around different costume makers, you know, you get used to how things can work in real life. So a lot of times, like, for people who have seen some of the artwork I've done, drawings I've done when thinking out a costume, I draw it very purposefully and very detailed to how I would actually do it. So I'll actually draw a little, you know, little tiny belt buckles on stuff with the holes in the belting, you know, or I might have like a belt buckle on like a thigh strap, and I'll be thinking about, okay, on this shoulder armor, I might actually have a little like threaded aluminum screw post through the cape that passes through like a leather shoulder pad and then through the armor that holds the collar armor to the back armor. So I tend to usually, whenever I'm doodling or doing a slightly more deep sketch, I'll actually be thinking through it like as if I'm actually sitting down and building the armor. That's just, you know, that's sort of how I go about stuff. But again, like I will say, kind of a unique case just because I am by trade a product designer, kind of do a lot of this built stuff for real life. So, you know, and then I also have the experience of, you know, I've been in the 501st since 2003. The Mercs, I would say I've been in for like 5 years or something like that. And then the Rebel Legion, I've been in for probably about 2 or 3 or something like that. So, I mean, I've been a costumer in a official member capacity for quite a while, and even a little kid in grade school and high school and stuff like that, I was always still, you know, building costumes and things like that. So I've always been doing that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, very cool. So with your extensive knowledge and focus on the original trilogy styling, what would you say would be the maybe a couple tips for new people designing their armor to try and stay to the classic iconic original trilogy stylings?
I would say things like don't be afraid to kind of take a little bit of extra time. Sort of like with flight suits, you know, if you actually go and look at a picture of me in the executioner, what you may not realize is the executioner flight suit is actually a regular U.S. military flight suit. What I did was I spent the time and I actually removed all the calf pockets, chest pockets, extra shoulder reinforcement, zippered thigh pockets, the little inside thigh knife pocket. I took all those pockets off, and then I repurposed the material to make the kind of Boba Fett style thigh pouches that I put on the thighs of the flight suit. And then there's not enough material to do a full second sleeve, like is what is on Boba Fett's flight suit and Jango Fett's flight suit. But what I actually have is kind of a cheater sleeve. I actually have like a what looks like a half sleeve, but it only goes from the front of my bicep to the back of my arm. But it's enough for me to actually have. I put a couple little X-wing pilot style kind of code cylinder sleeves or pockets onto the sleeve, and then I have that sleeve that I have the hose coming off the armor suit up into it. The other thing I did too is obviously I took the flight suit in, which the easiest way to do that for people who aren't as familiar with it is you just put the garment on inside out, pinch all your material, pin it or mark it, take it off, and just run a stitch and then turn it right side out, and you've now taken it in tighter. Because the worst thing that can happen is if you just take a U.S. flight suit, which I understand is, it's the nice thing that, the generic versions are $30 or something like that. It's very easy just to go with that because it's cheap.
Yeah.
The Nomad versions are what are like $100 or whatever. But the problem is they're readily identifiable as modern military gear. So the instant you see those like zippered pockets on the thighs, the pen pocket on the left shoulder, all that stuff, if you just take a little bit of time with a razor blade or a seam ripper, it does a lot to go ahead and kind of despecify the flight suit. Another thing is just, again, this is from my perspective, the way I kind of feel about things, just avoiding modern nylon type gear. So like, as an example, like an M4, a military nylon pouch is very identifiable. So Star Wars is very much, leather pouches, things like that. And, you can do things like make them from scratch, commission someone to make them, or a lot of times, there's a lot of people that have that, the Mosin Nagant or those type of leather pouches are kind of readily available all over the place. There's a lot of times, you can find just interesting stuff. I mean, there's a guy, I think it's Steven from up there in New England. He's got just a bunch of like what are probably like police pistol pouches, but they look great because he's got a ton of them around. They're leather and they're old and they're awesome.
Yeah, that's exactly what he has. Yeah,
just get leather pouch thing. I mean, if you can't afford to get a custom leather set commissioned, you can easily just a lot of times it's just for any costume. Best general advice as I can give is just taking some extra time. I know that a lot of times it's exciting that like you're like, ooh, I can get this done now. There's a con in 2 weeks that I want to debut it at or whatever. But if you just kind of spread it out a little bit of time to be able to source or save up those five extra dollars kind of thing, you're able to source stuff that will end up looking a lot more in universe, or your kit in general, you might be able to make a more cohesive thing versus just going, oh, I'm rushing to get this done. I've got this extra airsoft pouch here. That's what I'm going to slap on my belt, and boom, I'm done. So it's good to just be able to spend the time. And I often tell people this a lot of times, where sometimes it's worth kind of taking in a little bit extra time, saving up the money, because I know that, like, believe me, I mean, I've hit times of like where I've become unemployed, and it's like, well, costuming budget's on hold kind of thing. I know a lot of people are still in school. And, your budgets are kind of down a little bit. A lot of times it's worth just saving the money up, because a lot of times if you go the cheap and quick route, you eventually end up replacing that anyway. So you might as well go ahead and wait and spend the one chunk of change versus spending money now and then spending money again. And now you've spent more than what you would have just on one thing. It's sort of like, I could get this, I could get this helmet here, or I could get this cheaper one here now, but then in 3 months I'm going to replace it. So now you've spent the additional money that you didn't have to, kind of thing. But yeah, but also going back, it's like just avoiding stuff that's very recognizable. I mean, that's why obviously like modern, you know, camouflage patterns just don't work. They're prolific. You know that it's a modern pattern. You know, in the Star Wars universe, armor and parts were usually painted, again, doing the original trilogy thing, you know, armor parts were usually solid panels of color. Even the camouflage that you did see on, like, the Endor troopers was very just blotchy kind of spray paint kind of look onto the fabric and the pants kind of thing. So
it's almost like the costume designers didn't take so long on those costumes that were going to show up for 3 minutes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just like, hey, camouflage, let's just, you know, spray paint these pants and this jacket here really quick kind of thing.
Yeah. Yep. And in the Merc CRLs, we also have it as no modern or common off-the-shelf camo patterns can be used anyway. So on that regard, we're good.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, it's tough because, I mean, I know a lot of times it's like you got to kind of take a step back and think, like, is this kind of recognizable? There's also the, you know, will this potentially confuse into, say, another genre or realm of costuming? You know, I mean, that's why, like, I'm personally a little bit iffy on, like, say, chainmail on a Mando, just because I go, well, chainmail is very much known as, you know, the
fantasy
kind of
thing
in a fantasy type realm, yeah, versus Star Wars, and I don't think we ever see chainmail in Star Wars, so it's kind of a, you sort of start mixing the realms, you know. The hardest thing too can be sometimes for a person to disconnect from a genre that they're used to working in. It's sort of like a lot of times, and I, you know, it's just an example, that kind of a fantasy, medieval type realm, you can get people who do a lot of costuming and do a lot of work in that realm, that genre, and then they come into the Mercs, and because that's what they know, that's what they kind of stick with, and that's what they do. But Star Wars is different than, you know, fantasy. So it's tough. It's like, you know why you can't really, you know, why it's a bad idea to have a weapon that's a very identifiable weapon from another series or genre on your Mando, because guess what? You're going to be that guy where somebody goes, oh, nice pulse rifle on your Mando, you know, kind of thing. Or, you know.
Yeah.
Cool, you got Captain Mal gun. Captain Mal costume? No, you're doing a Mando. All right, that's Captain Mal's pistols. You know, it's like, you kind of, thing where it's like you got to be cognizant of the fact that, I mean, we're all in today's world, we really know our stuff and we know the details where we'll spot something and you're gonna have to deal with always questioned or somebody pointing out that thing that kind of stands out, you know.
Yeah.
And that's just, I mean, I'm sorry I'm kind of rambling a little bit, but it's like
that's,
you know,
good.
Weapons are another thing in the Star Wars universe where for the most part you saw kind of like the World War II ish looking weapons with like wooden handles or wooden grips and things like that, and like a leather sling. And the easiest way to do, you know, a Star Wars weapon is like take a gun and you put 2 to 3 scopes on it. You know, you just get the old
stuff. Yeah.
And you put them on backwards and or upside down.
Exactly. You know, now I know that there's exceptions to the rule, like the, you know, the Endor troopers and the Hoth troopers used like, you know, M16s that were, you know, messed around with kind of thing. And that's honestly that blaster rifle that I built for the Executioner is an M4 receiver, extra C pipe, and you know, stock mated to it and everything like that. But that's why sometimes, like, you know, certain guns are just a little bit too non Star Warsy to me. I mean, if you're repainting like a you know, like a Super Soaker gun, it's like, yeah, it's looking a little bit more Men in Black, not so much Star Wars, you know, kind of thing. So.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's just been kind of being cognizant of that. And I mean, I know the other thing too, like when it comes to blasters, is always like the Nerf weapon kind of thing. And the problem is, there are some pretty cool looking Nerf stuff. Believe me, I was involved with Nerf things when I worked at Hasbro. You know, they got some cool stuff when I was there. And in the years since I've been away from there, they've come out with even more cool stuff. The problem is, you see it so much, like you see them all over the place and everywhere. Identifiable, you know, so that's
yeah. I work at a store that sells books, and I see on a lot of like pulp sci-fi, like soldiers and the the badass heroine lady, and they're all holding long shots.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm having a brain fart. The TV show where they were going back to dinosaur times from
Terra Nova.
Terra Nova. Oh man, I tried to watch that. This is minor tangent. I tried to watch that 2 weeks ago, and I could not get through the first episode because I just kept seeing Nerf guns, and then the dude had a Tyrannosaur skull. And they were talking about allosaurs and the Cretaceous, and I'm like, no!
Yeah, that show wasn't too long-lived. It was, I don't know, I didn't mind it, not to get too off-topic here, but yeah, it was very much, the Nerf guns were very unmodified, and the fact they also used, like, standard motocross armor.
Yeah.
Yes,
I was looking at the show, and I was like, all right, you know, looking past a bunch of stuff, this is kind of neat. Oh, maybe I should do a costume. I can recognize all the parts. No way, it's way too recognizable.
Yep.
No one's going to understand what it's from because it's like you're a guy with a Nerf gun and motocross gear.
And the motocross stuff, I mean, you know, if you're in the costuming realm, some of the earlier days of, you know, if you're ever at a convention, some of the earlier days of the Halo costumers, you'd see them wear that stuff as their Under Armour kind of bodysuit stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a British post-apocalyptic zombie movie, but the specialized team that they sent outside the wall in this APC, all their suits were that motocross armor. So I mean, it's like, you know, it's so tough when like there's a thing that becomes very commonplace and seen in a lot of different areas. It's kind of like, all right, you got to take that step back and realize this is kind of recognizable. Maybe I shouldn't use that, you know, kind of.
Yeah, some things are just too iconic.
And I mean, and there's some cases where it's okay to do things like that. For example, when that is canonically what they actually wear.
Oh, yeah.
Like in Mortal Kombat costumes, there's a whole bunch of, actually they don't make it anymore, so now it's really expensive, but
yeah.
That's what the cyborgs wear in Mortal Kombat 2 and 3, is they're actually wearing motocross armor because the Mortal Kombat characters are actually photographs of people taken in positions of the sprite sheet, so all those costumes existed.
Yeah.
And so finding that specific piece of motocross armor for that specific costume, that's all right.
Yeah.
But Mandalorians don't ride motocross bikes.
Yeah. Well, and even to kind of go with the idea of like things being too common or becoming too commonplace. You know, like one of the things too that personally, and again, this is just my personal beliefs, you know, you know, what happens is a lot of times, and generally it's because in the consumer product realm, they're too readily available. But, you know, you get things like for the longest time, and luckily it's been a while since I've seen a lot of people use them kind of thing, but like, say, like Jango Fett's pistols, we're led to believe that these are very specialized custom pistol builds. But yet for a while there, it's like, oh, everyone had one. Even in the comics, he had, what's his name? The one Jedi, you know, used them.
Oh, okay.
You know, or had one of them. So it's like the Westar 34 became this very thing. And it's even like the Verpine Shatter Rifles. I mean, when you read those Republic Commando books, you're led to believe this is a very fine, elegant, fragile weapon that's really super expensive. And yet everyone and their brother has one now. So it's like, are they that, you know, rare and special, or are they a super manufactured item?
But everybody wants
they also underwent that complete redesign too, when because the original Verpin rifles were like these weird ass bug guns because they're made by bugs for bugs.
Yeah, well, and the Verpine, I mean, all their stuff, because the Verpine design, like the Y-wing, or not the Y-wing, I'm sorry, the
B-wing,
the B-wing, yeah, and honestly. I sort of believe that they like the look of the Verpine Shatter Rifle or pistol in my brain, the closest actual real Star Wars weapon or pistol that I thought they maybe looked like was closest to in of all things the prequel trilogy in Revenge of the Sith, these sort of like stun pistols that the Tantive IV crew carried. And the one visual dictionary is a nice picture of it, but the shape and the kind of elegance of that pistol in my brain whenever I was reading the Karen Travis books was more kind of how I visualized those items. You know, to a certain extent, It was sort of like if you ever watched Star Trek Enterprise, the Mako.
Yep.
Yep.
Right. You know, that kind of curved or you know, organic shaped sort of thing.
More sleek design, yeah.
And a very...
Well, they look like modern sniper rifles with the ergonomic stocks and the interior grips and that sort of thing.
Yeah, versus like this very utilitarian heavy look kind of thing, you know. I mean, so you know, basically I said earlier, or what I was just kind of pointing out is like being careful to not take something that's commonplace or specialized and make it commonplace. You know, sort of like why for the longest time I was doing Mando helmets with no rangefinder was just because you kind of think that maybe Boba Fett, you know, he got this armor, he did some upgrades to it, maybe the rangefinder isn't a standard thing on the helmet.
Yeah.
In fact, the helmets, I always looked at them as kind of a, you know, just to bring in that automotive analogy to it, is you got to think about this helmet kind of coming off a production line. You know, one model has the rangefinder, you know, one model is just ear caps. I tend to not like helmets that seal up the lower visor area, which is ironic considering that two out of the three helmets I've ever done sealed up the lower. But the way I would always seal up the lower visor area was that I would follow that very slightly curved plane of the mandible, or what's referred to as the mandible area, you know, the area just outside the T-visor. Yeah. If you kind of look at it top down, there's a, you know, it's a curved plane. So even though in that, it's like less than 2 inches, it's like, you know, 1.7 inches wide, you know, the visor area isn't flat across, it's like slightly curved. So if you're able to splice in a piece of plastic that's slightly curved that matches up to that plane, that looks like, you know, there's one of the helmet makers did a helmet or produces a helmet that has no visor area cut out, it's just that area is smooth. And that's a good way to kind of look at the helmet as a base model, you know, kind of thing, which is whatever specific cutout for the visor area. So that's why, you know, a lot of times it looks rather abrupt or a little odd sometimes when to seal up the visor area, people just kind of, for lack of a better term, it looks a little slapped on, you know, it just kind of looks like, oh, here's this thing that I have, you know, just on the outside of the helmet, you know, with no blending or shaping or you know, you got to kind of pay attention to the curves and the shapes and the planes that are present in the helmet to figure out, like, does this look good or does this look a little slapped on kind of thing? I mean,
right.
And kind of get like, you know, there's a lot of doodles and sketches I did where you're kind of like, you know, where could it be a good spot to kind of add something on? Like maybe the key slots are an area where a communication box could be or clipped into, so that's a spot that might be all right to have like a little box with an antenna off of it. You know, the ear caps are a good spot to have like a different ear cap or something. If I'm going to seal up the visor, have a different shaped visor, make sure to follow that plane that is the, you know, the visor surround area kind of thing. So those are things that I tend to look at or view when I'm looking at the armor kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So another topic I wanted to kind of quick is how to analyze artistic input or a reference for custom armor. And this is something that I was kind of benefited by my time at Hasbro and also, you know, again, being a product designer, is when you look at stuff like comics as a reference for an armor suit kind of thing, a lot of times what you have to take into account is that artist's style of drawing something. For instance, one of my favorite comics, I mean, I've got the comic is completely broken up and worn out and pages are starting to fall out, is Open Seasons. I mean, of like, oh, here's Mando's on Mando's different suits and colors and yes, this is it kind of thing, you know, when it came out. The chest armor almost looks like a cape. You know, you've got like a K on one side and a reverse K on the other side. That's just that artist's way of drawing that chest armor. What you should assume is that for this to be in real life, it's Boba / Jango shaped chest armor, not that it's this bizarre shaped armor. So a lot of times artists, especially comic or graphic artists, have certain styles of drawing things. you know, a good example of this would be if you, I mean, just picking up various comic or, you know, comic books, or if you do stuff like watch, you know, like how the Matrix had that, the Animatrix DVD where it was like set by different, you know, animation styles. Same thing with the Batman, where there was like that, you know, Batman DVD that was like done by a couple different animation style people, you know, all completely different ways of animating and styling what would be real life people. And so similar thing in the comics, you know, I mean, there's some comic artists are very, draw very realistically, for lack of a better term. Some of them are a little bit more stylized. So a lot of times you can't really take an image in a comic book at face value. You have to kind of go, all right, here's this new suit that's being presented to me, or here's a new costume details being presented to me. How does it relate or apply to the real life suit that I know? That's why, like, one of my personal opinions on, like, loincloths are, loincloths should probably be a decoration over top of cot armor, you know. When you think about it, it's kind of like that, the girth belt. It's sort of like a ornamentational type thing, same as like the girth belt or an extension of the girth belt, not necessarily that that you've got the bulletproof loincloth, you know what I mean?
Right.
You know, and that's why, like, you know, a lot of times too, it's like the Mandalorian helmet or the Boba Fett helmet, you know, it is very iconic that it's, you know, round dome on top, rounded cylindrical type back, cheeks are indent, you know, you got the flat plane surrounding the visor, you have indented high cheeks and then flat low cheeks kind of thing. Personally, when it comes to like the legacy comics, even though it's kind of drawn where like the cheek area looks rather curved or whatever, my personal opinion has always been that that was kind of an artistic style, and that maybe there should be an indented cheek, even if it's a very minor indented cheek, a la the Clone Wars, you know, Mandalorian helmet, which has like, you know, the high cheek area.
So you had mentioned that a lot of the costumes in the original trilogy use like utilitarian fabrics and leather work, but perhaps you could name like top three most commonly used materials that just don't look very original trilogy for those that are trying to stick with more of an original trilogy style for their armor.
Yeah, okay. I'd say probably top materials to avoid if you're going for like an original trilogy look would be nylon, you know, whether it be kind of the example would be like a nylon belt or nylon like
pouches
kind of thing.
Nylon pouches, belts, and straps, that's what you always see.
Another thing to avoid would be stuff like tight stretch fabrics, you know, so like, you know, Lycra bodysuit kind of thing isn't really original trilogy, you know, especially Mando or soldier type suit. You know, and really anything that's like, anything that'd be kind of a really shiny material, or even a very like gloss or, you know, sometimes you get some of those like, that are very, very glossy, you know, it's just, it doesn't look real. If you're ever, you know, because believe me, I do leather work. I know how expensive leather can be. Putting candy leathers kids through college, you know. If you're gonna go for a non-leather, like if you go to your for those of us in the U.S. like Joann Fabrics, Hobby Lobby type, a lot of times if you go more towards the back, they'll have, I guess current marketing terms today is called vegan leather, or, you know, pleather, you know, vinyls that are more meant for like kind of automotive type upholstery. These will typically be on like the 5 foot wide rolls, and they'll be about $30 per yard. So it is the more expensive, but again, it is like a 5 foot wide roll, so a yard gets you a lot. But they're very flexible. Their embossing and print is very realistic to real leather. So that, you know, that's a good option. Versus sometimes a lot of people end up going with the you'd more call it like the marine grade vinyl. you know, the print or the embossing isn't as good, the colors finish don't look as realistic, and plus, I mean, anything in the costume is going to make you hot. The marine vinyl especially, I feel like you get pretty hot in it, and it's very stiff. Like, I've found that it seems like it doesn't have a lot of stretch to it, so times to have, like, if you're going to use it to make, like, say, an armor vest out of, you've got to do a lot of, like, very good custom fitting, or throw in some, like, princess seams or darts or things like that to make it fit very well, versus if you actually make a real leather, or go ahead and go with, like, the little bit more expensive, kind of upholstered vinyl towards the back of you'd find in, like, the back of the store. It has a stretch to it, so you may have to worry about throwing as many darts in it and stuff like that. Plus, it tends to just being a little bit thinner, pliable, it's a little bit easier to work with.
Sounds like some really good options there.
So I just say, like, just reading that, it's basically like nylon tactical gear is avoided. Stretch lycra spandex type stuff is to be avoided. And then stiff. The one caveat I usually give, there's exceptions to every rule. You know, like, one of the things, and I'm going to probably offend some people, and I apologize, but, like, what I call, like, outlined armor, where you have, like, a border around the outside of the armor, sometimes can be a little dicey on whether it looks good or not. Some people have done that very well. Some people surprise you with having a slightly spandex or tight-fitting portion of their suit. You know, Emma, I forget her Mando name.
Faye Oyer, I think.
She had a
failure.
Sometimes tighter fitting parts, and it looks pretty good. Again, there can be exceptions to the rule in anything. I've seen people who have used Nerf guns. You know, it's a Nerf gun, but they do a good job. I mean, there's somebody who took one of the Nerf guns where it's that stock that, like, the two pipes and then a piece and two pipes and then the 90 degree, but and wrapped it in, like, leathers or fabrics or something like that. So it disguised most of the stock. I mean, being that I worked on Nerf, I know Nerf. You know, the way they did it, it disguised it compared to a lot of people who just used the straight-up Nerf thing. So there are exceptions to every rule, but that's not necessarily a cartridge to go out and break the rule, as it were.
Well, I'm actually kind of curious. It's been really popular recently to see a lot of people working on alien Mandos. And there have been numerous instances of alien Mandalorians detailed in the canon. For example, there in the Crusader period, they have an entire set of panels where you see, like, 10 to 15 different types of alien Mandalorians.
Sure.
And I'm curious as to, obviously, a number of aliens can be aliens that are human repaints, because that's how Star Wars works.
Yeah.
So, for example, a Chiss. There's no way to tell somebody's a Chiss from the outside.
Exactly.
But, for example, Twi'leks. Twi'leks are a relatively popular race, and are additionally a relatively popular choice for custom gear.
Yeah.
So I'm curious as to what you think is an effective way of doing a Twi'lek without going absolutely nuts.
So off the top of my head, and honestly not off the top of my head, because I've kind of seen this sort of question posed before, the little thought I've given to it is, like, one way would be you could potentially do something like, say, take, like, the Mando, the Boba Fett style helmet, and that the back round or tube that's below the visor where the key slots.
Yeah, the ridge.
Yeah. Below that ridge, that back panel, you could potentially remove and, say, have, like, a tough utility fabric type thing with openings in it that the Leku are coming through. Kind of think like the Twi'lek X-Wing pilots that you see that have the kind of, like, the Snoopy cap that fits with their Leku. Another
Snoopy cap. That's exactly what it is, too.
Some people like this, some people won't. Yeah. For those that don't know, it's the Apollo astronauts type thing. They refer to it as a Snoopy cap because of the white and black coloring on it. And they wore that below the flight helmet. But
yeah.
We call it Snoopy cap because everybody loves Snoopy.
Right, yes.
Something like if you took a Fett style or a Mando style helmet and you basically had like two imagine kind of like a conical tip missile or something cut in half kind of thing on the back of the helmet, so that you had this sort of shaped portions almost like the back thruster areas of like the space shuttle or something like that. I'm just trying to give you ideas of like that shape, two of those on that back portion of the helmet that allowed for like a area for the Leku to be hanging out of kind of thing. That might be a way to address, say, a Twi'lek Mando. I've seen some people where they started to kind of for like a Rodian Mando have looked at, instead of having like a big T-visor, having like two kind of bubble lenses that would be like over where like the eyes would be kind of thing. So, there's ways of doing that kind of stuff. And if it was something like, say, like a Chiss, I'll admit to not being familiar enough beyond, reading like the Thrawn trilogy, a while ago kind of thing.
Familiar enough. That's the best instances of the Chiss, anything by Thrawn. Yeah. Or anything by Zahn, excuse me.
If you wanted to be a Chiss Mando, at a big event, one of the celebrations or something, obviously, you paint your face, you have the contacts, you walk around without your helmet on. Other than that, you make sure to do something like, say, on your helmet, on your chest armor, on your shoulder belt, something. Go ahead and, if there's stuff in the comics or the books that is a Chiss symbol, just lettering or something like that, you put that on the armor. And I always go towards for like Fett kind of stuff, I'll look at like the original art of Star Wars books. You see some of these Ralph McQuarrie and Joe Johnston sketches, some of the symbols they put onto the Fett armor in those sketches. So it's just kind of because you can kind of pick up these little interesting details that, kind of exist within the Star Wars universe and design realm, use custom thing. You don't often see them. So there's ways to do that. There might be something like particular, societies or races or whatever from the Star Wars universe might have little details or greeblies or things that they always have with them. Chase down there in Georgia, he was doing like kind of a Kiffer, I think that's how you pronounce it. At one point at my house I was living down there, we had the little kind of star in the circle belt buckle, and we're weathering, painting it up and weathering it, and that's on his belt kind of thing. You kind of try to figure out, is there a way that I can tie in something from that universe into it kind of thing, so it's just, like I said, you look at like visual guides, the movies, art books kind of thing, and you just kind of pick out stuff that you might be able to kind of toss in there. Even potentially weapons, that are specific to a race, if there's something that like some particular race uses weapon-wise, ceremonial blade-wise, or something like that. You sort of celebrate and kind of make that a nice focal point on your suit, but necessarily go crazy. In the case of like a Rodian, don't go, "Oh, Rodians are green, so I'm going to paint all my armor and put little suction cup stalks over my armor or something." There's kind of there's a phrase called KISS, keep it simple, stupid, in the design world and stuff. And it's sort of it holds true to a lot of stuff. You don't want to go too crazy.
Yeah. A few subtle nods is better than an overwhelming force of certain style.
And even I've seen a lot of paint jobs, just kind of a rough colors, when you look back at your source material that you've actually seen on screen, you get like Boba Fett and Jango Fett. And, Boba Fett is, just a couple colors and kind of solid blocks. Jango Fett is solid silver with a couple little color details kind of thing. And I've seen, chest or whole body armor schemes that are like five colors with like crazy patterns and overlaps and whatever kind of thing. And usually the advice I give to people when they're kind of dead set on having a visually interesting pattern
is garish.
is limited. You know, like, okay, if your chest armor is going to have, you know, this pattern that crosses all the plates and you've got four colors going on in your chest armor, keep it to your chest armor. You know, let your leg armor or your shoulder armor and your gauntlets be solid colors. You know, you want to kind of create like a focus. When I've seen pictures of armor where the color or paint scheme of the chest armor is repeated onto the helmet and the thighs and the shoulders and the gauntlet, it becomes very visually distracting. It's kind of hard to sort of, you sort of like lose focus visually. You know, if you have something that you want to be your special focus, make it that. But know when to kind of scale back and simplify elsewhere. You know, everything can't be a crazy, you know, overly complex pattern. And that's why I get worried when you start seeing like, you know, we're being introduced to this new character from Star Wars Rebels, and it's like, oh man, the helmet has a complex paint scheme, the chest armor has a complex paint scheme, the shoulder bell is the checkerboard, the other shoulder bell has a, you know, it's like, oh man,
she doesn't have any gauntlets on.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Like, you know, it's kind of one of those things where if you want to make something crazy, make that your focus or make that your little detail kind of thing. Don't let it run throughout. You know, again, it's the whole keep it simple kind of principle. You know?
Yeah, it needs a focal point.
We have several Facebook questions asked, obviously, on the Facebook for both the Mandalorian Mercs Costuming Club and the Kel Dabi Talk radio page. One of the first ones, and this is actually sort of a two-part question. The first part is from Tyrick Keel. Sitting with jetpacks, is it possible? The answer is yes. Yes, it is.
Having done so, I can tell you it is in fact possible.
Yes.
And that wasn't a jetpack, it was wings.
I can't say I've sat down with a jetpack, but I have sat down in my Republic commando armor with that massive backpack on. It's just a matter of perching right at the edge.
Yeah.
But you can still sit down.
Yeah, I have a radio pack. It's all the same sort of stuff. You just sort of, you got to realize how much projection you have off your back and then just, yeah, compensate with the chair and realize you are going to be uncomfortable.
If it's not a fixed seat, you can turn the chair sideways and just sit so that way the back of the chair is to one side of you, and then it's no problem at all.
Yep. And the second part of the question, from David Spartacus Weimer. Speaking of jetpacks, what is the best way to secure one to your back? His is apparently fairly heavy. Lots of different options. One that I see the most common, because Jarek Dar Alarad for my very own Wampa Clan, the way he did it was he just took his back plate, because he did go big, and instead of going home, and he has a back plate and a jetpack. And he,
ooh.
Yeah, I know, right?
And brave man.
What he did was he essentially took the jetpack and he actually cut the middle of the back of it out and cut the middle of the back plate out, so it's just this big hollow cavity, which saves a lot of weight. And he just riveted them together. So he has this back plate, backpack unit that he just puts on over his vest and, you know, has a strap system in there, but the back plate is taking all the weight, so it's not like sitting just on the straps.
Which equates to the armor vest, then, you know, the back will drag down on the armor vest, which will drag the armor vest up against your throat on the collar on your front side. Mm. If you're mounting this to essentially what ends up being your armor vest. Especially if you've got a heavier backpack or jetpack. Yeah. If you're talking like camp style, there's a internal harness where it's got straps that poke the vest and the back plate, and they've got large rectangular rings on it, and the jetpack has flat metal, bent metal hooks that hook into that strap. Things like Jango Fett in the harness that they tend to wear, or the Jango Fett style I've seen a lot of guys do, is a very nice, broad piece of fabric across their chest that kind of takes a lot of that load and can kind of be cinched down. You can also do things like kind of sneak a strap from the jetpack down through your armor vest, down to either an internal belt or even just kind of slipping out just at the belt hook up to your ammo belt or your like an underbelt for your cod piece or something.
Next question. This one I think would best be directed at Thaxos, the man who flies from Winnipeg to Florida like what, 4 times a year? Something like that?
Hardly that all.
Sports good.
but every now and then, yeah, I happen to frequent planes as a method of travel. I do drive to a fair number of these places too, but yeah. So Lemzig D is asking, what are the best ways to transport armor via plane, shipping companies, etc.? And what are the worst experiences you have had or heard of? And I laugh at that because I definitely do have a worst experience. in my experience, it's probably easiest depending on it all depends on the armor you have, right? So depending on how you can pack it, it'll either be easiest to transport by plane or by vehicle, depending if the drive is convenient or not. Shipping companies tend to be quite expensive when it comes to the actual size of space your box is going to take up. They don't charge you based on weight. They just go strictly based on the amount of space in their truck that you're using.
And I can tell you, too, that the one danger of a shipping through like a shipping company is like I have a friend who sent her Commander X and on the long trip did like the ship that ended up having this huge chunk broken out of the, she had like one of those kind of like standard Stanley type, you know, the big toolbox kind of things.
Yeah.
What you have to realize is a lot of these shipping places for the big stuff, they might be unloading their trailers with forklifts. And if it's just sitting in a setting where there's forklifts running around, the potential of a forklift tooth coming over and nail in the corner or something.
Ooh, yeah.
Based on my brief time working at like a UPS sort facility is, yeah, stuff doesn't happen that gently with unloading and moving stuff. So there are sometimes heavy stuff that might fall or slam against your bin.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've actually, the weird thing is that I have seen greater success with paper crates than I have seen with actual Rubbermaid bins. Like, yes. I've seen people who use paper crates because paper crates don't go on the bottom because they're smaller. And if you can pack your stuff into 2 paper crates, it'll actually probably turn out safer than if you put it in the one large Rubbermaid bin. It may not be cheaper, though it actually might be. It depends on where you're shipping.
And depends on the size of the boxes.
Yeah, but I found that paper crates generally get preferential treatment.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. I would say steer clear of shipping companies if you can at all avoid it. When it comes to transporting via plane, it's quite nice if you can have your container fit within the checked baggage size restraints, which yes. I think is 62 linear inches, if I cover recall correctly. Mm-hmm. Something in and around there. But
no more than 50 pounds.
Yeah.
But always, you know, double check with whichever airline you're flying with. So yes, the weight is also another consideration to have. For me, I think the entire armor bin weighs approximately 28, 30 pounds. And what I always do, now this doesn't really work if you're bringing multiple suits of armor with multiple helmets, but I'll have the armor bin as the checked baggage. I'll have my carry-on luggage. And then I will have my Mandalorian helmet in a motorcycle helmet bag, and that is my personal item. It does fit under the seat in front of you, and they treat it just like it's a laptop bag or a purse or whatnot. So that the personal item, the helmet bag, is free. It's with you, so even if you lose the rest of your kit, at least you got your helmet. And the checked baggage is, you know, typically $25 each flight. So really, it's very inexpensive to bring. If you were looking at doing that shipped, it would be well over $25, I can tell you that much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do kind of have a side question related to that. If you are taking your armor and stuff as your carry-on sort of thing, like how do the
check baggage
or check, well yeah, but I mean, well, like your helmet and stuff like that, does the do you ever get like weird looks from the TSA?
two part answer. Yes. I've had them give me weird looks for what sort of helmet I have in the helmet bag. Mm. B, not really, because I'm wearing a Captain America jacket half the time I fly, because it doesn't fit in my luggage itself, so I just wear it on the plane, and that tends to be the talking point instead. So if you can wear some sort of part of your costume, that is a normal article of clothing, like a leather motorcycle jacket, then yeah, you're
don't
set.
Wear a jumpsuit, guys, please.
Yeah, yeah. Don't try and wear your armor vest through. Don't wear a jumpsuit. Don't.
Your patch jacket's okay.
Yeah, your patch jacket's fine.
That'll be fine.
But yeah. But don't try and wear the helmet itself as a hat or something, like, you know. There's
you'll get shot.
Or armored gloves or anything silly like that. Don't do that. But yeah, for the most part, the TSA will just go, what is this? If they don't really know, mm-hmm. You know, they will ask you. They're not just going to haul you off into some side room and, you know, subject you to 20 hours of questioning. I've never had that happen yet. you never know on the next flight. Now, in terms of worst experiences I've had or heard of, definitely would be when my friend and I went down to Celebration 5. And we decided to fly, but since we were taking the Republic Commando armor, in addition to the Mandalorian armor that I had, there was not a chance that we were going to get it to fit in the regular sized checked baggage requirements, so it would be oversized. And knowing the airport's capabilities with oversized luggage and handling, we decided to opt for...
Or lack thereof.
Yeah, we decided to opt for the shipping companies. Now, we went with a certain shipping company whose vans are brown, that we will not name specifically. And
I have a reputation for this, by the way. I know several other customers that have had issue with them.
Yes. Basically, what we had done was we'd figured out what hotel we were staying at for the duration of being in Orlando. And we phoned ahead, and they had this company store inside their hotel. And we called to confirm that, yes, they can receive the package if we are not yet there, because one of the interesting parts about the shipping is that you have to get the timing down right for you to receive it. Now, sending it to a friend would probably be a much better option, but for not necessarily being able to do that or wanting to have it right there on hand, instead of having to travel over to the friend's place or have them bring it to the convention center, would be to have the hotel receive it. Now, when we arrived, it was... you know, late evening, not really too far late. It was maybe about 7 o'clock, I think, at that point in time. And we went over to the shipping company store inside the hotel and went, all right, we're here to pick up our costumes, because we had shipped it sufficiently in advance to make sure it would arrive before we did. So that way, no matter what, it wouldn't arrive late, because that would be the worst part of going down to a convention and not having your costume with you.
Ooh.
So
until the last day of the convention, or arriving after you've left.
Or arriving the day after you're gone, yeah. Now, we went and said, well, you know, we're here to pick it up. And they said, oh, we don't have that. It's on the truck. to which we replied, why is it on the truck? We asked if you could receive it, and you said yes. And they said, oh, but, and me being from both of us being from Canada, they said, oh, but there's a processing and handling fee that, you know, there's some sort of customs dues that need to be charged, and we don't pay for that. It stays on the truck till you pay for that, which was not made clear to us in the slightest. A bit of arguing ensued, and we basically, you know, told them that was unacceptable, that we had confirmed that this would be here on time, guaranteed, and we phoned up one level of management above that person to try and sort things out. And in the interest of expediting this story, basically what happened was that another worker for that store, who was on later, located the parcels. That was the other thing, is they wanted to charge us, in addition to the customs fees, they wanted to charge us a storage fee, even though they claimed it was on the truck, which was absurd, because if it's not being stored in their storage area, which is local, then it's on the truck. You know, you don't pay if it's not being if it's stored on the truck and not in the storage facility. Turns out it was indeed stored. We didn't have to pay for that storage fee, luckily. But we didn't get it till 11 p.m. that night, and the, you know, Celebration 5 was the very next day. So that was a bit dicey. In addition, we were trying to finish those, and it took us a while. So by the time we actually shipped it down, we really only had 2 weeks for it to get there, which very much so increases the price of shipping. That's the other thing. If you do want to ship it and you don't want it to cost you an arm and a leg and then some, you'll need to ship it on the slow boat to China method, which means you'll pay the least amount, but you'll also probably want to give it like a solid month to get there. So I really just don't recommend shipping it in the slightest.
The only time you should really ship armor is if you can ship it to someone who will meet you at the convention and is willing to slap your crap around.
So good luck finding one of those.
Yeah, because I've actually done that for people before, and that always happens without incident, and they're just shipping by U.S. Postal Service, and this is where I learned my factoids about paper crates.
Yes. So if anyone's going to Con Carolinas, contact Frost, and he'll be the armor receiver.
Or don't!
Receiver. And he will haul all of your armor to the con. No.
Or I will resale it. I haven't decided yet.
You'll have to work out the specifics with him on that one.
Yeah, going back to the when you're taking it through the airport, like with carry on, obviously if you've got like your helmet and say you have stuff like sound systems, mic systems, or fan systems, take your batteries out.
Yeah, I almost forgot about that. I don't have any electronics in my helmet.
Batteries attached to it.
Batteries are a no-no on airplanes, guys.
Yes.
Furthering to that, I happen to have my helmet without any electronics in it whatsoever, which makes it nice and easy to go through security. But at one point, for one of the cons, I had tried to bring down some lights that would be installed into a friend's helmet. So it was the raw wiring, the circuit board, and the battery. And security was like, no, you either got to toss this or we need to spend all this extra time investigating it. And it's like, okay, fine, we'll throw it in the trash. it's $7 worth of wire, LEDs, and some a circuit board. But yeah, okay, not worth my time. So if it's not securely mounted in the helmet, that's probably also another thing that you should rectify.
Yep.
If it's shown that it's installed in a helmet and it's not easily removable, they're less likely to have an issue with you. They're less likely to suspect that you might pull it out and use it in some nefarious plot or something, you know?
I'm building a bomb out of batteries and shoelaces.
They will take you to the side room and interrogate you for 20 hours if you say that in the airport. So don't say
yes.
that.
Oh, yes. Do not actually say that in an airport. That is a great way to end up with your cavities probed and your motives questioned.
And banned from ever flying anywhere again.
Yeah, pretty much.
Another thing too is like on your check luggage, what is I think just suggestible, and I've always done it, is I usually whatever costume is in that particular luggage or bin or whatever, I will just make a little 8.5 by 11 printout, just in Photoshop or Illustrator, where I will get like the official look Star Wars. I'll put like Star Mandalorian armor and like a picture of either my suit or a sketch of the suit or a picture of a related costume kind of thing, and I'll type up a little blurb that says, you know, the contents of this bin contain non-firing replica prop weapons,
yes,
stuff like that, just so that when invariably the TSA take it out and check your bin, that's right on top, so they know, okay, I saw a gun-shaped silhouette, but this thing says this is theatrical props, non-firing, and they'll dig through and look at it. But they're not like expecting this idiot is, you know, real life firearm, unsecured, and you know, no trigger lock kind of thing. And I'll usually suggest like, you know, either orange tape or red tape around the barrel or something like that, just so it's like, okay, this is fake. You know, I've even put like either white or colored zip ties around the trigger, essentially con-safing my weapons in the bin that's being put in a check luggage.
See, that's an interesting point.
Another thing you're allowed to do is you are allowed to put zip ties on your zippers. The reason this is important, especially if you have weapons that cost a lot of money, is that if you have your zippers zip tied, that means that you will be notified if the TSA has been in your bag looking at your stuff. The reason that's important...
Luggage. Okay.
Yeah, well, if they've been in your luggage, look at your stuff.
I was thinking, an armored bin, and you don't really have zippers on those, but yeah, if it's on, like, a carry-on or something.
Even if you have an armor bin, before you go, find the overlap, drill a hole through it, and put a zip tie through that. The reason being is because they're going to have to cut it to open it. and they can't replace it, especially if you pick a weird color or something. It's important to know whether or not the TSA has been in your stuff. They are supposed to put little paper flyers in. I know a couple of people who have worked for the TSA before doing baggage check, and they don't always put them in there.
Yeah.
It's important to know because sometimes things will go missing from your bag because somebody had to go rooting through it and just forgot to put everything back. Or maybe somebody took your weapon out, looked at it, played with it for a little bit, and put it back. That's not uncommon either.
On both of those notes, both what you're talking about and what John had previously mentioned here, I've actually never tried having an itemized list or any sort of indication of what's stored in the contents of my bin. I've never had a problem thus far. All of the prop weapons I have are purely plastic in nature, so they don't have anything that would, you know, on an X-ray scanner show as looking like it's any sort of functionality for a firearm. And so far, it's not been any issue. I do sometimes have to, at least at the Canadian airport, there's a section to drop off oversized luggage that then gets scanned right away. And sometimes they'll ask me, oh, what's inside here? And I just tell them, oh, it's a Star Wars costume. Now, all my armor plates are metal, but none of the weapons have any metal in them. Yeah. And then in addition...
Other than like the springs or stuff for the triggers.
Well, I tend to... Yeah, other than a spring, which is going to show up as a spring. Which,
yeah,
really, or not even
it
at all.
A spring
it's
and super... a circuit board. Wonder what that is.
No, I pull the circuit boards out typically.
And I mean, my thing of just doing that little printout that's like right on top when you open up the suitcase or bin is purely CYA kind of preventative measure of like, okay, if they're gonna open it up, see this kind of thing. It's not even like,
yeah,
what's in there. It's just that I go, this box contains theatrical props, and that's how I'd even identify as this is theatrical props, just because, I mean, if you say Star Wars costume, even though we all say that everyone's seen it and everyone loves it, you're going to get stares from people, you know?
Yeah.
Yep.
And that ties in with what Eric has said, where sometimes the TSA will take stuff, when they're searching it, will take stuff out, even play with the guns. I've opted, and this is just my, and I don't know if this has been effective or not, but I've opted not to have any sort of indication of what the stuff is inside. Just in the thought that, having heard of friends who have had, say, a Halo rifle in there, and they've listed that, you know, it's a prop Halo gun, and they actually had it damaged, and through the investigation as to why their property was damaged, they recovered some security footage from that baggage check, where the TSA employees removed the rifle, played around with it, dropped it, broke it, and then put it back in. I'm not sure if they actually recognized it as Halo or if they, you know, read the little informational thing. They went, "Oh, this is cool. It's Halo," but I prefer just to have it as generic as possible, in the hopes that doesn't happen. I did at one time have one item misplaced. Luckily, it was just some Sith robes. And not any of the Mandalorian armor right underneath that, which couldn't conveniently the airport the airline was very prompt in cutting me a check for the value of that custom Sith robe, of which a dollar amount was basically up to my deciding, which was great. You know,
in
that regard, I mean, you write it down as a custom fabricated blah blah blah, source some similar commission based site, and you know, you can get the full value of that, you know, in terms of not just the raw materials, but the time and effort that goes into making it. So in that regard, at least with the airlines, they're pretty straightforward in terms of refunding the money when it comes to a lost or misplaced item. As opposed to a shipping company, which will probably argue, you know, oh, it was packed improperly, or, oh, you know, that's not our fault somehow.
We lost your package, but it's not our fault. It's your fault for shipping it with us.
And you didn't buy the additional insurance that you're supposed to have.
Yeah, you didn't buy the $150 extra insurance. For the
super premium shipper's insurance, as opposed to the regular, we cover you for $50 or something like that. So... I would sum up, I would say fly and bring your helmet as a personal item, or drive it if you can, and ship it only on last resort and to a friend, not to a hotel.
Yes.
And, hell.
Now, sometimes it is easier to ship than it is to fly. It is usually cheaper. But, again, you want to make sure that certain pieces do not get shipped. Never ship a helmet to a convention. If you've done mods to it, if it's got hot glue in it, whatever, just don't ship the helmet. Just take it as your personal item on the plane. Because helmets get warped and damaged, and anything you ship is going to get exposed to all sorts of different temperatures. And it's just fly with it.
Yeah. Additionally, whether you're a guy or a girl, the benefit of having that helmet bag and you having your helmet inside of it is typically a helmet's pretty hollow. I don't know how much electronics and other stuff you guys cram in, but you can actually fit a fair amount of stuff inside your helmet bag. You know, if you wanna store some additional items in there, or even tuck your purse in there if you have a purse, then you know, you don't really have to go without. Yeah.
I put my merch in my helmet.
I would.
Yeah. So depending on the size of the stuff you want to bring with you anyways, that you would otherwise have to give up that personal item, laptop bag or whatnot, just tuck it all inside the helmet and you're set.
Well, when it comes to packing, I mean, like, generally speaking, like, you know, gauntlets are usually where I put, like, gloves. I tuck the hoses in. I put the girth belt in. Helmet, I'll put my... you know, my costume, I've got the leg wraps that I roll up, and so I tuck a leg wrap into the, you know, one or two of the leg wraps into knee armor, put the other knee armor over that.
Oh, yeah.
So it's all about, like, you know, start nesting things and thinking about, like, okay, this brittle part put inside the armor part take a lot of a beating than that brittle part, you know?
Yeah, packing's a whole other strategy that we just don't have time to go into. Next question.
Jacob Aganoy, has anybody dealt with rowdy people, like invading your personal space or tried to mess with your armor/weapons? 99% of the time, the only rowdy people you're going to have to deal with are kids.
Yep. And the other 1% of the time, it's the inebriated. Yep.
Yeah. Who you can basically treat like the children. Con,
then it's the inverse.
And I've kind of found through years of costuming, I've been 2000, you know, fired my first for 10 years. It's kind of funny, kind of almost hit the age ranges of knowing that, like, this age range to this age range is mesmerized by you or you're realistic. Then you hit a little age range where they're like, they got to prove the, like, you're not real. I know you're not real kind of thing.
Yeah.
You hit an age range where they're like, this is kind of cool. And then you kind of jump into those sort of, like, later teens where it's sort of like, I think this is awesome, but I can't let my friends know that I think this is awesome, so I'm going to be, like, cool, quote-unquote, like, mess with the armor or do, you know, phallic signs behind you or whatever kind of stuff. And, I mean, I've had some times of, like, in not in a Mando costume, but, like, in my Commander Bly, I remember doing a Special Olympics event when I was living in Pennsylvania at Villanova University, and you know, it was kind of funny because you hit the it was in the morning, and you start towards noon when, like, you know, the college kids kind of started to wake up and come out and about, and because of the fact that the blasters are in plastic box holsters on a leather outside my hard arm. Thighs outside of me, you can't really feel if someone's really slick about pulling the pistol out.
Yeah.
Somebody had come up behind me, pulled one of the pistols out, but, like, helmet, and I just, like, turned around, saw this, and I don't know how I managed to do it, but I, like, whipped my hand around, snatched the pistol out of his hand in one motion, holding the pistol in that hand, had my pointer finger out, stuck it practically up his nose. This suit is really expensive. I can't see anything. How is that even, like, you know, right in your mind? And this kid had this, like, just, I mean, he couldn't believe, this college student couldn't believe that, like, the costume character managed to snatch the gun and was... Sometimes the response is, like, you go full bore at him of just, like, you don't, you know, I mean, and I've told people that in varying degrees of intensity of, like, you don't do that. Like, you know, I usually list, like, this costume is expensive. We can't see very well. We can't hear well. You know, you've got to respect that we can't, you know, really deal with that. And usually people tend to kind of back off and go, oh, sorry, don't, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, well, people don't like getting called out for being a jerk.
Yep.
Yeah.
You call them out and they're toast, pretty much.
Yeah.
Depending on the sobriety.
True.
That's true. That's very true.
I mean,
most of the people I've had to deal with have usually been people who are varying degrees of inebriated. Typically they are, typically they're the ones who believe that they are entitled to screw with your crap. Exactly. Which is the weirdest thing. But I've only ever had anybody try and steal a part of my costume once, at which point I gently placed my left hand, I don't know how many of you have seen my costume, on that person's shoulder, at which point they realized that they should probably go ahead and give me back the shoulder bell. So being tacit, gentle, whilst also letting them know that they need to stop whatever they're doing right now is the best way I've found to approach that situation.
Well, and the thing is, too, like, I found, like, in, say, a Mando costume, where there are no requirements to what you look like under the helmet, as opposed to, say, like, when I'm in my Vader or a Bly, where it's like, I can't really remove my helmet because that destroys the perception, whatever you want to call it, the scenario. Like, as a man, you can point and go, hey, what the heck do you think you're doing? What's wrong with you? And usually a lot of people, when they see the, like, costume character remove their helmet and engage them directly...
You've humanized yourself. You're no longer the faceless, yep, individual, you know, random person.
Now you're an angry person wearing a full suit of armor.
Yeah.
Yes. Carrying weapons around, as opposed to some dude in a costume who you can push off of the pedestal that he's standing on in the famous example of the Yautja from Louisiana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as a 501st member at events in the past, if there's like a kid or a person messing with me where there's like no adult taking care of them or they're not taking the hint, even though it's kind of frowned upon because you kind of ruin the magic, I've pulled my helmet off and yelled at somebody before or taken off and very sternly talked to them, just because it's like, okay, we've hit a point where this is the only way you're going to listen to me and realize that you're in the wrong. So, I mean, sometimes it's that. I mean, the ultimate answer is, you know, don't be out alone in a crowd. You know, usually have a buddy or more. Especially, like, a lot of times, if you can have a handler, referred to as a handler, which is a non-costume person, or sometimes a costume person who their costume
mobility
helmet. Having that person with you, they can sometimes directly engage the person who's the aggressor or the problem person that you may not be able to easily while you're in costume and in helmet.
Yeah. Now, I've had a couple instances. One, I had to step in for a friend, and it didn't really require too much of me doing. I just walked over, and one of the great things, now this is kind of the opposite of humanizing yourself and taking off the helmet. You leave the helmet on, they can't tell what your face looks like, they can't see where you're looking, and if you just kind of have your T-visor pointed right at them and you stand pretty close to them and just stare directly at them, you know, it tends to be a little intimidating and off-putting, and they typically get the hint and leave if they're bugging someone.
Oh, human nature is you get very uncomfortable if you can't actually make eye contact with someone.
Yeah, well,
if you're used to wearing stormtrooper helmet, whatever, you can look directly at the person, and a lot of times they're not making direct eye contact with you. I mean, it's usually pretty funny because we as customers, because we've been in the helmets and in the suits, we know exactly where the eyes are, so we can make eye contact with the person in the suit. But general public, they don't know where your eyes are, they don't know where you're looking, and it's very uncomfortable to just kind of nature wise to not be able to engage on that kind of personal level or being able to look or engage in eye contact. So yeah, it's very kind of makes them uncomfortable.
Yeah,
it's why people like sunglasses so much.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, one of the I do have the one other incident where I was at Dragon Con, and this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with where it took place, the venue it was at, There was a group, you know, two, three drunk 20-something guys, you know, 20-something-year-old guys. And one of them had obviously had a fair bit to drink, and he approached me, and for some reason, yeah, it started off that, he, you know, it sounded like he thought it was cool. He was asking some questions about the armor. I mentioned that my armor is metal. And then he got it into his head that he wanted to punch the metal because, oh, that would be cool somehow. And, you know, I tried to verbally dissuade him from doing so, and I said, you know, you're going to hurt yourself. I got segmented plates. They've got rolled edges, but after that, you know, the edges is not exactly, it's not exactly a soft, flat edge. It's not exactly perfectly smooth, and it's rather narrow, you know. If you're punching and you kind of scrape along, you can slice your hands up pretty good. So obviously that was not a good thing for him to do. Now he decided to, you know, this is one of those things where at some point the person is just going to go ahead and do it, whether or not you try and talk him down. And so you can tell when the body positioning shifts, that, you know, he's going to throw the punch. Luckily he didn't, you know, go for the gut where it was more so the pointed plates that would slice the hand open, but he just hit one of the pec armor. But I saw that coming, and I you know, rather than try and avoid it, because I figured he would just go for another swing, I, you know, leaned into it, planted one foot, and of course, that's one of the benefits of having metal armor, is that it actually will absorb a fair bit of, you know, force, you know, from a punch thrown at it. And so I just kind of leaned into it. You know, he hit pretty hard, but he didn't dent the plate, and he was very, very shortly after turning around and walking away holding his hand. And I didn't have to deal with anything beyond that. But, you know, I was trying to stay aware of where the other individuals were in case it would become something more of an issue. Luckily, I knew that a friend of mine was, you know, 10, 15 feet away, so if something happened, I could enlist his help in diffusing the situation.
Yeah. The big thing is always, like, if at all possible, the buddy system of at least having somebody else with you or in a group, or have that non-helmeted or non-costumed person with you as a handler. You know, if you had a bigger con or some cons, being aware that, hey, I can see that you know, staff member or security member is over there, their attention, bring their attention to the person. Like, you know, if the person has an altercation with you, then kind of walks away, go over to a security person and be like, hey, that guy over there, you know, he looks like this, that shirt.
Yeah, promptly report it after as well, yeah.
Yep.
And a lot of times, too, especially, like, you know, a lot of times the biggest problem is always, like, a rowdy-type person. A lot of times it seems like, you know, about 50% of the time, usually able just to kind of go like, hey, man, just to let you know, I can't see really well, the costume's really expensive, I can't tell what you're doing. A lot of times, in their drunk state, they're kind of like, oh, sorry, dude, all right. And they, you know, they kind of go on their way. So about half the time, or, I mean, if you just inform the person who's kind of rowdy or invading your personal space, you know, or if, like, you know, if they're grabbing at your weapon, just go, no, this is expensive or it costs a lot kind of thing.
Yeah, they get the hint.
Tend to back off. If they're more aggressive, having either a handler with you or the security from the con or whatever really helps out.
Yeah. If it does come down to it, though, and they're going to be the aggressor, hands up, palms facing towards them, tends to be a more neutral stance to kind of dissuade them from doing anything. And obviously you want to get yourself out of the situation as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. You don't want to engage and further the confrontation, because that'll land you in some trouble as well.
Yeah. Yes, especially
if you're traveling, especially if you're traveling to a con where you're not local, because then you have the issue of having to deal with the local authorities, and if something does come out of it, all of a sudden you're required to still be around, even though if your flight leaves, you know, the next day, which would suck.
Additionally, the Mercs has a policy against aggressive behavior, so... in order to, basically, the Mercs requires that all of its members are always being the better person in any sort of engagement similar to this. Mm. As a result, that means it is not only expected but required of you that if someone is being aggressive, that you need to be in a situation where if any action is taken at all, that there will be a number of people who vouch for you not being the aggressor. And so that is 100% required of you.
Yeah.
So if you do find yourself in an altercation-like situation, you're wearing like 3 to 4 layers of cotton and metal and or plastic plates. The person is probably not wearing any of those things and is likely to break themselves upon your body. Yeah. More than they are more than they are to actually even bruise you. So it's not worth the trouble to you, because it could damage how you are perceived or your eligibility for membership within the Mercs, and it will certainly cause problems at the convention. Ultimately, the best thing is, again, like John said earlier, buddy system. I have never once had any sort of negative altercation when there were 2 or 3 of us around. I mean, periodically, and this is more true for women than it is for men, women will have a tendency to get lewd comments, which is a very sad commentary on
the individual state
of gender relations in the Western world. But
just go ahead and say it, too. It's like, I mean, a lot of times, you know, like in this case of Jacob's question with the you know, rat people, you know, and then people invading your personal space, one of the things that you'll just have to respect when you're in costume is people in a perfectly innocent, sober setting, you're going to have people tap on your shoulder armor, chest armor.
Yeah.
Is this real?
It's about what the material is. You'll have people potentially touch, point at, grab at your weapon. A lot of times my favorite thing to do is when I've had people, you know, because again, I've been in the 501st longer, so I've been in Stormtrooper armor, I've got Darth Vader, I've got Commander Bly. A lot of times you'll have people come up, knock on your armor, I reach out and knock on their shoulder. You know, it's like, just kind of like, hey, what's, you know, what are you made out of, kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's purely innocent, it's purely, you know, curiosity. You know, the best case scenario is someone getting in close to you and doing something like that, they actually ask, can I touch it, what's it made out of, and you just hold your arm out and touch it. You know, for the most part, it's also being able to just inexperience over time, learning when is it pure curiosity, when is it totally innocent, and when is it potentially a dangerous, aggressive situation, because it happens either way. You know, I mean, sometimes you're at events, and the majority of the time, it's just somebody who's curious. They are, it's a totally innocent situation. So, yeah, at a more party atmosphere, like a sports event, or a party convention late at night, like at Dragon Con, yeah, you might have more of the, this person is inebriated and aggressive kind of thing. But again, due to it, the best advice is just, you know, buddy system, know that it might be purely innocent. Just kind of play it off as like, you know, just informing the person like, hey, I can't see well, / I can't hear well, / the costume is expensive. And usually people are like, oh, I'm sorry, or oh, I totally understand. Hey, I just wanted to ask you, or I wanted to know what this was made out of. And, you know, that's the majority of your time. It's
yeah. As much as we stress that things could potentially be an issue and what to do in that situation,
it's usually not.
It's typically not the case, and we just want you guys to be informed if it ever was to happen, as opposed to trying to, you know, we're not trying to make this out to be fear mongering in any way that, oh no, you know, every con you go to, you got to be aware and constantly vigilant. Not at all the case. And typically, when someone approaches you or gets too much in your personal space, the likely best thing to do is to open a dialogue. If you start conversing with the person, then they're going to typically respond, and you can easily gauge the situation based on their responses.
And that's why, like I was saying, it's kind of it's a good thing, because again, I'm a unique perspective, because I'm what can you call it, tribal. So I'm Legion 501st and Mercs, and
me too, man.
you know, 501st and Rebel Legion, depending on the costume you have, kind of by default are don't remove your helmet ever in view of the public because you don't want to ruin the magic.
Yeah. Mercs,
there's no, except for somebody like Boba Fett or Jango Fett, there's no set thing. Like, you are as the costumer, the person. There's no set rules for what you look like without the helmet. So as a merc, you have the special advantage of being able to, if someone's totally pestering you, you can pull that off. And I tell you, times out of 10, taking the helmet off is an instant shutdown to whatever they're doing, because it's like, suddenly it's like, oh, it's real. This person has taken their helmet off. I have to look them in the face. They're no longer this abstract character for me to be amused by, kind of thing. So
exactly.
So if you've really got somebody pestering you, you're able to take the helmet off in view of the public and just kind of be like, hey. And as a general rule, people by nature don't like confrontation. So, you know, you take someone off and looking them in the eye and being like, listen, you need to stop, kind of thing. Or, hey, I can't hear you or see you, or that's not respectful, and this suit cost X amount of dollars. Sometimes people don't realize that not for hire when we're at events where it's purely voluntary. And secondly, they don't expect that. They're thinking like, oh, the suit's like provided by the venue. It's like, no, dude, I spent $1,000 and, like, you know, 80 hours of my time doing this. This is all handmade. And they kind of realize, oh, you know, like, I shouldn't be messing with this person, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, that is about all the time we have for this month's edition of Keldabi Talk Radio. Just thank you for listening. Tune in next month. We'll be talking about more stuff, such as weathering your armor and how to efficiently pack it in, like, a nice shippable container, however you choose to do that. But for now, I am Crow, thanking you for listening. With me this time was Thaxos, Frost, and our special guest, John Ficker. Thanks, and have a good one.
Bye.
Have a good one, everybody.
John.
Yes.
Say goodbye. I said goodbye.
What? You clip.
This has been a production of the Mandalorian Mercs Costume Club. If you'd like to learn more about the topics discussed on today's show, please visit www.mandalorianmercs.com. The Mandalorian Mercs is a worldwide Star Wars costuming organization comprised of and operated by Star Wars fans. Star Wars, its characters, costumes, and all associated items are intellectual property of Lucasfilm. Copyright 2009 Lucasfilm Limited. We hope you enjoyed our show, and we'd love to hear your feedback. Please email podcast@mercs.firespray.net. Until next time, happy hunting.
Awesome. You clipped the last time too.
Awesome.
Everybody.
Beginning of that.